So, we heard last night in the reading in the puja that episode of the Buddha where he sends out his 61 disciples and he sends them out for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good, for the happiness of gods and men. So that was a very crucial point in the Buddha's history, in the Dharma's history. In where at that point, the Buddha was sending his teachings out on this great journey. It was clear, in a way, from those words of the Buddha that they weren't teachings of sort of individual spiritual liberation, but a path in which one's treatment of others, in which one's interaction with others is woven into one's own liberation, is woven into one's own freedom from suffering. And from that point on, the Buddha's teachings would always be at their most transformative when they connected most deeply with the world around them. Right from those early days of Buddhism, where the Buddha's teachings reached out to all parts of society in India at that time, across divisions of caste, of gender, from one kingdom to another. And then later on to, you know, the spread of the Dharma. Those first 61 turned into many more, and the Dharma spread to all parts of southern and southeast Asia. Then you have the flowering of the Mahayana, which really took that ideal of altruism, and it flowered in these beautiful forms that we see around us in the shrine room of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which are really embodiments of this ideal of one's own spiritual quest for the sake of others. And so the journey continued down the generations, the journey of the Dharma, great practitioners keeping this connection to the world vital and alive. And the great figures of the refuge tree among those, as well as many figures not known to us. And so that journey that was set in motion, sending those 61 disciples out, in a way it's still there in the world. You know, that journey that the Dharma is making has come down to this present age. It's come down right to, you know, the age of modernity, and it's entered a vastly, massively changed world that's changed both for good and ill. It's a world that those bodhisattvas of old would be hard pressed to recognise. In its the scale and complexity of the world. So what of that noble ideal of the Bodhisattva? Is it something to be confined just to the walls of the shrine room? Or to sort of tales of Bodhisattva, quaint figures of historical antiquity? If the Buddha's teachings are to mean anything in such a world, then the Dharma needs to make a kind of cultural leap, perhaps greater than any of the other cultural leaps that it's already made from one culture to another. The leap from the traditional world into modernity. So that leap, that transition of the Dharma, this Bodhisattva ideal, in a way, we can see it in our experience. We can sort of look at it from a historical perspective, but in a way that leap that has to be made is there right in our own hearts and minds. We experience it in a sort of tension between our ideals, between our sense of purpose in life, meaning, beauty, truth, our connection with the Dharma in that way. But also in our experience, we have all the sort of distractions that go with living in the modern world. Often in our world, just we're aware of a scale of suffering in a way which is quite novel. You know, it's not usual in human history to have people that are aware almost instantly of suffering on the other side of the world. That's something that's new to us. That's also in our experience, and it can be overwhelming. There's a threat even to the basis of life itself in the modern world. Again, this is something quite new. It raises a new sort of existential challenge. The sheer amount of information and stimulation and misinformation, with all the dangers of sort of distraction and superficiality that brings. The consumer culture plays on our minds. It plays on our desire for material comfort and security. Can so often lead to just a kind of apathy, a withdrawal into one's own little armchair. There's strong pressure to conform in our world to society's norms. There are deeply held views in the world coming from theistic religions or the sort of attitudes of materialistic nihilism, the idea that everything is just reducible to matter. A very, very strong view that's there in the world. There's a culture, you might say, of sort of cynicism and mistrust, which actually affirms negative emotions and values. And of course, there are still very strong ways in which we identify with, you know, particular nationality, a particular race, a particular gender or religion or political affiliation. Those divisions are as strong in the world as they ever were. So this is where the journey of the Dharma, the journey that the Buddha sent the Dharma out on, this is where it's arrived, right in our own hearts, right in that sort of space, that tension that we might experience between our inspiration with the Dharma and the ways in which the modern world sort of impinges on our experience. What the Buddha exemplified was, in a way, his whole life was a total response to the world that he was living in. His quest for an answer to the world's suffering involved every aspect of him. His awakening, his teaching, his friendships, the Sangha that he gathered around him, were one single response to the suffering of the world. And it was a response at the deepest possible level. So what might that look like nowadays? So what I'd like to do is, in a way, just imagine, or at least sort of begin to imagine very tentatively, what a 21st century Bodhisattva might look at. So I have 10, no, 9, 9 things that have come to my mind about the 21st century Bodhisattva. So the first thing, As ever, the Bodhisattva will act from right view. Wisdom is the most essential quality of the Bodhisattva. How the Bodhisattva sees the world. So sometimes you get the idea that, oh, you know, you'd have to be a real Bodhisattva, you know, to go to such and such a place and teach the Dharma or something. As if the Bodhisattva is just a very altruistic person, you know, a person that does a lot of good. And of course they will. But the point is that that comes from a radically different way of seeing life. Comes from a radically new way of seeing reality, of seeing self and other and the world. Of the nature of consciousness, of what it is to be embodied in a human, in human form. And this is very important. You know, it's not just that we sort of have our practice and then do a lot of good things and that makes us a Bodhisattva. And in particular, looking at the sort of views that are in the world at the moment, it will not do to sort of bolt on sort of good actions to a kind of basic materialistic, nihilistic view of the world. Going down that path, we'll just burn ourselves out, or we'll just attempt to sort of meet the problems of the world at their own level. And in a way, things will just sort of go round in circles. So somehow we need to really be open to seeing things anew. Sangharakshita has this idea that we need to view things. Well, we need to see things as alive rather than dead. It's as though when one experiences more life within oneself, one feels the life in other things, even so-called inanimate things. You feel that everything is alive, that the universe is alive. So this isn't just a view that we can just adopt overnight, but I think it does mean that we need to be really open to seeing that our sort of habitual ways of seeing things are limited. That there are sort of further perspectives. Not a simple thing to do. You know, can we at least begin to imagine, you know, that idea of seeing everything as alive? Seeing the universe as alive. In a way, begin to imagine where that might come from in a sort of playful way. How might it feel to actually experience reality in that way? So, wisdom, right view. Somehow what this gives us is the ability to at the same time sort of hold the suffering of the world. This is the wisdom of the Bodhisattva. Being able to hold all the suffering of the world while at the same time dwelling in bliss. You know, that seems like such an impossible thing to do. But this is the way, this is the wisdom of the Bodhisattva. So that's the first point. The second one, the Bodhisattva will always be motivated by metta, by love, by compassion. Every act will be suffused with love and compassion. You know, the Bodhisattva will be alive to the world. Again, to quote Sangharakshita, an attitude of withdrawal from public concerns into purely personal ones is one that is not worthy of a human being. Not worthy, at least, of someone who is trying to be a human being in the full sense of the term. It represents an abdication of responsibility. So the Bodhisattva will be alive to what's going on in the world. And yet we know that often if we do sort of open up and engage with what's going on in the world, the result is sometimes just a sense of overwhelm or a sense of anxiety or anger, or sort of getting into political opinions or sort of adopting kind of right-on views that sort of conform, or right-on sort of practices that conform to, you know, what our friends on Facebook expect or whatever. But the Bodhisattva will come from somewhere else. It's no place for apathy, but we need to go beyond. The Bodhisattva will always come from love. In a way, the resolution between apathy and all those sort of negative responses, the resolution of that is loving kindness, is metta. Waking up to the sort of the real livingness of other, of other people and all living beings. So one way of talking about this was from Dr. Ambedkar, Bhimrao Ambedkar, the great Buddhist leader in India in the 1950s. And he uses the slogan, liberty, equality, fraternity. Okay, which he says he borrowed not from the French Revolution, but from the teachings of the Buddha. Liberty, equality, fraternity. And I mention it at this point because really that is an expression of loving kindness. On one level, they are political ideals at a very sort of high level of society. But they're also rooted in loving kindness. And one can actually sort of see liberty, equality and fraternity as a kind of unfolding of the metta bhavana. You can sort of see it as three stages of, first of all, an attitude of liberty. When we bring somebody to mind in the metta bhavana, perhaps the first thing is just to sort of liberate them from our own expectations, from our own sort of labelling, from our own judgments, you know, whatever that might be, or liberating from what we want from them. So liberty, you know, liberating other beings from our stuff, is the sort of first stage, it's the first step of the metta bhavana. And then the next stage is equality, of really sort of seeing the equality of their experience with ours, the sameness of their experience, seeing that they, just like us, they're beings, they're embodied beings, with that they experience pleasure and pain, hopes and fears, and so on. Just like us. So we perhaps can equate that sort of natural cherishing we have for ourselves with the cherishing of other people. So equality is rooted in that aspect of the metta bhavana. And then finally, fraternity, which you could say is the actual, that aspect of metta, which is actually willing to act, is ready, is the readiness to actually act for the other person's benefit, for the benefit of others. This is fraternity. In a way, it comes naturally, it naturally arises out of this sense of the equality of self and other. So, liberty, equality, fraternity. in a way, what's remarkable about that is that it's taking values that are rooted in love and kindness. And in a way, there's a sort of seamlessness between that and our kind of collective political life. So that one's actions collectively, whether that's just who you vote for or in the example of Mbedko, working tirelessly for the so-called untouchables of India. It comes from those values, liberty, equality, fraternity. It's simply an expression of love on a vast scale, on a big scale. So this is, this will be where the Bodhisattva comes from. In a way, whatever actions we might do in the world, whether that's running a Buddhist centre or being politically active or just sort of expressing values through our conversations and relationships and so on, they will always come from actual, heartfelt, loving kindness. They're not just sort of ideals or ideas, but an actual movement of the heart. Okay, so the third thing I'd like to say about the 21st century Bodhisattva, and it's sort of arising from this, that the Bodhisattva, as ever, will practice non-harm. Violence isn't new in the 21st century. It's always been there in human experience. But perhaps what is different is just the sheer sort of scale that violence can take. You know, in the Buddha's time, there was war. There was sort of large-scale animal sacrifice and so on. Nowadays, we still have war, but of course, because of technology, it's the destructive potential is vastly greater. And you've got things like drone warfare where, you know, you don't even have to be there. So the Buddha actually put himself physically. You know, the Buddha actually walked at one point between two warring tribes. He actually put his body physically in the way of that sort of conflict. What would that look like in the 21st century? You know, if we were to take the same degree of sort of commitment to peace, what would that look like? I'm not sure I've got an answer to that question, but what I'd like to just sort of refer to briefly is six guidelines for making peace in the world. And these are drawn from Sangharakshita's lecture called Buddhism, World Peace and Nuclear War. So I'll just say what they are quite briefly. One, consistently act on the realization that humanity is indivisible. Okay, consistently act on the realization that humanity is indivisible. Secondly, intensify our commitment to non-violence with a more ardent and selfless love. A more ardent and selfless love. Thirdly, find non-violent ways of resolving disputes between individuals and groups. That actually takes some work, I think, to understand how to do that. Fourthly, and here's one, rid ourselves of even the faintest vestige of nationalism. That's quite apposite in our times, I think. Number five, become a louder and clearer voice of sanity in the world. speak up for peace. And finally, practice the Buddha's teachings more deeply with regard to birth, death and craving. So that's from the idea that problems of violence in the world, that their resolution comes right down to the very sort of basics of our practice, of what it is to be alive, and our relationship to craving. So we need to take that and practice more deeply. Practice the Dharma more deeply. So perhaps from that, from those six guidelines, we can ourselves begin to imagine what the 21st century Bodhisattva would be doing in the way of working for peace. But I'll leave it to you to work out the details. We all have to work out the details. So fourthly, a Bodhisattva will be working against the tide. Well, what is the tide in the 21st century? Getting stuff, making profit, even sort of achieving things. The bottom line is often profit, isn't it, in our world? So clearly this is not what the Bodhisattva will be about. The core value, the core thing that the Bodhisattva is working for is spiritual development, spiritual liberation. And in a way, what the Bodhisattva will bring about is a culture of spiritual development. So Sangharakshita, again, drawing from the Sutra of Golden Light, he talks about, in a way, all aspects of society being subsumed, being at the service of spiritual development. And again, I think we just need to use our imagination somehow to work out what that might look like. So he talks about agriculture, commerce, the arts, sciences, medicine, law, government, administration, diplomacy, transport, communication, advertising, entertainment, sport. Right, imagine that the bottom line of all of those areas isn't profit, but spiritual development. What on earth would that look like? You know, what would sport look like if it was really about spiritual liberation and development? Or advertising, or the arts, or sciences, technology. And the point is that, you know, we're all involved in society in a way. So we're all involved in these areas. So this brings up sort of real questions in ourselves as to, you know, our own activity, our own involvement in the world. How can that be subsumed to the liberation, the spiritual development of the individual? All our relationships, all our interactions, all our every time we sort of buy something, our economic relationships, social relationships, how can they be subsumed to? In a way, what we're talking about is waking the world up. This is what the Bodhisattva is doing. The Bodhisattva wants to wake the world up. So what does that mean in practice for us? Okay, so the fifth thing I'd like to talk about. The Bodhisattva will always be a unifying force. Having said that he's sort of going against the tide, or she is going against the tide of society. At the same time, the Bodhisattva will be a unifying force. Whether on a local level, in one sort of local community, and also on the global level, beyond notions of nation, race, and even religion. So again, just going back to Dr. Ambedkar, he has this sort of vision of society in India as being characterized by constant sort of mutual support and help and interaction. In his words, society needs to be full of channels for conveying a change taking place in one part to other parts. In an ideal society, there should be many interests consciously communicated and shared. An ideal society is primarily a mode of associated living, of conjoint communicated experience. It is essentially an attitude of respect and reverence to one's fellow men. So, in a way, you know, think of the place that you live. Is it just a place where people happen to have their houses in the same geographical location? Or are there actually ways in which communities are sort of supporting and helping each other? Are there sort of common goals for the good that people are working towards? Is there an attitude of sort of mutual help, mutual sort of looking out for each other? You know, we can think about that on a local scale, and also on a global scale. And it seems to me that the world, in ways, is at its best when there is some sort of common project, something sort of idealistic that is being worked towards. An example that comes to mind is, you know, after the Second World War, when the League of Nations, the United Nations, was set up, the idea of sort of creating an order that would lead to peace in the world. There was an idealism about that. You know, it wasn't just a political idea. It actually came from a deep idealism and a desire not to experience war again. Somehow that's got lost, I think. There's no shortage of things that the world could unite around. There's no shortage of good that needs to be done in the world. But somehow there isn't the sort of unity there to inspire quite enough people. So the Bodhisattva will be involved in this level. The Bodhisattva will be conscious of the needs of people around and about, both sort of locally and globally. I think for us it means that sometimes we just need to get out of our bubble. To get out of the sort of bubble of like-minded people. You know, go and visit your local mosque or gurdwara, or homeless shelter, or care home, or women's institute. For the world, we need to be part of, and to sort of offer, be part of a greater transformation that's taking place. And we need to be willing, remembering that we need to do that out of loving kindness. Let's not just sort of rant on about people we disagree with, or sort of rant on about people who are in power. We need to do what the Buddha did. And what the Buddha did was actually go and speak to people, he actually spoke to people in power. In a way, using that Quaker phrase, he spoke truth to power. But more than that, he showed loving kindness to the kings and Brahmins of his time. So there'll be no place in the 21st century's Bodhisattva's activity for sort of moaning on about those who hold power. Instead, the challenge is to actually meet them or you know, people who hold power in smaller ways who come within our sort of ambit. And communicate with loving kindness, speaking the truth as you find it. So that's the fourth point. The fifth one. I think a 21st century will be connected with nature. In a way, this perhaps went without saying in the Buddha's time. But I think one of the things that characterises the 21st century is a sort of pathological ignorance of nature. You know, I'm tempted to say that in the Buddha's time, animals were being sacrificed, but at least they were regarded as having some sort of place in the cosmos, some sort of significance. Whereas animals nowadays, I think, are just regarded as nothing, as sort of meat, or just sort of not regarded at all. So I think there'll be something about the Bodhisattva's attitude to the living world, but I'd particularly like to talk about our attitude to animals. As human beings, we've given ourselves the huge technological power, and we've got the power to either cherish the animal world or destroy it, to borrow David Attenborough's phrase. And by and large, we're choosing to destroy the animal world. One of the root vows, the traditional root vows of the Bodhisattva, is not to destroy places inhabited by living beings. And that includes all living beings. So it's not just towns and villages, but in modern language, habitats. So I don't think a Bodhisattva in the 21st century would just be standing by and letting the sort of whole-scale destruction of the natural world happen. On the positive side, nowadays, there are, you know, scientists moving in the direction of, in a way, waking up to the sort of experience of the animal kingdom. You know, originally, Descartes had the idea that animals are just automatons. They don't really experience things in the same way as we do. And that attitude sort of underpinned, sort of justified a huge amount of suffering on animals. But nowadays, scientists are beginning to realise that actually animals have emotional lives. They actually experience friendship, fear, grief, love, even kind of romantic feelings of love. And in some cases, such as elephants and dolphins and octopuses, apparently, scientists describe what they call near human levels of experience, of consciousness. So I think that really bears reflection in a way, because I find that the thinking about that is quite awe-inspiring. It inspires me to see a sort of deep sense of awe and love towards the natural world. So what would that look like in terms of a Bodhisattva? Actually, the image that came to mind was of Sangharakshita's teacher, Chetral Sangye Dorje, who used to make an annual trip to Calcutta and buy up all the sort of living fish in the markets and take them to the Bay of Bengal and set them free again. In a sense, well, what was the point of that? You know, they'd probably just be caught again by the fishing boats. But anyway, Chetral Sangye Dorje was communicating something. He was teaching the life, even that of a fish, is something to be cherished. You know, going back to that sense of liberty, equality, fraternity, in a way, that, you know, we need to liberate the animal kingdom from the idea that they're just animals and don't matter. We need to sort of see the commonality of they actually have felt experience. They actually cherish their fish bodies in the way we cherish our human bodies. There's an example. Chetral Sangye, you know, he wasn't doing that just out of sort of right-onness or sort of militant vegetarianism. He was doing that out of a deep cherishing of life. Okay, so the seventh thing. And again, it sort of arises from this attitude to nature. It arises from this sense of the universe being alive. And what Sangrajita sees as the need for a more animist view of the world. And that is the need for beauty, culture, and the sacred values beyond the merely material. So the Bodhisattva, I think, will naturally express this connection with life in terms of beauty, in terms of a sense of the sacred, perhaps of rituals that that emphasise our connectedness with life and reconnection with life, that affirm life, and that also affirm something that sort of transcends mundane materialistic worldviews. There's something about our culture in the world at the moment, certainly in the modern world, that's somehow just sort of one-dimensional. You know, perhaps it's about entertainment rather than meaning. So the Bodhisattva in the 21st century will break out from this. The Bodhisattva will express beauty and a sense of the sacred. Again, it's for us to work out the details. The eighth point, the Bodhisattva will always gather Sangha. The traditional activity of the Bodhisattva, expressed in a list called the Sanghavastus, which are a whole new thing, a whole different thing. Traditional activity is to build spiritual community. Now again, coming back to Sangharakshita, one of his great insights about the Bodhisattva in the 21st century. Given that the Bodhisattva path transcends individuality, is that actually the 21st century Bodhisattva will arise within or as a spiritual community. I think this was a kind of genius way of putting it, because given our sort of individualistic psyche in the 21st century, the ideal of the Bodhisattva could so easily be mistaken and turned into some sort of individualistic, messianic, narcissistic sort of me saving the world kind of mentality. And the idea that actually the work of the Bodhisattva, the nature of the Bodhisattva, is something, it's not about something that I do, it's not something that I can sort of bolt on to me and my ego, that it's actually something about us and about spiritual community. So this is what Sangharakshita actually set up Triratna for, the FWBO as it was. In case you didn't realise it, all the sort of practices, the whole sort of practice scheme of Triratna are basically bodhisattva practices. So if, to the extent that you are involved in the Triratna Buddhist community, you are on the bodhisattva path. So the bodhisattva, the 21st century bodhisattva, isn't somebody else over there. It's us. Because if we don't do it, who will? So it's perhaps completely different to what we might imagine. Not a person, but a spiritual community. The ninth and final thing I'd like to say is, for all that I've just been saying, the 21st century bodhisattva will defy any expectation or definition or understanding. Don't take what I've been saying as a sort of manifesto for a 21st century bodhisattva, because really, who are we to say? Who are we to sort of stipulate the activity of a bodhisattva? They won't be predictable or conventional, and they won't be perfect. The great grace of bodhicitta, of the arising of the will to practice as a bodhisattva, is that it arises precisely in the dung heap of flawed individuals and flawed communities, because it's got nowhere else to go. So just to draw things together. I think sometimes the reason why we might feel troubled by the state of the world, part of it is that we don't feel a sense of being part of any kind of resolution. In a way, what we need to do is take our response to the way the world is, whatever that might be, anxiety, numbness, anger, frustration, and put it into our practice, and communication of the Dharma. Take all of that energy and put it into our practice, and have the confidence that the Dharma is the deepest possible response to the world. That generating positive states of mind, acting with respect to life, ending cycles of reaction and hatred, living simply. These are all powerful forces for the resolution of the world's suffering. And I think it's just a basic human need that we need to feel part of the resolution of things. Otherwise, you know, real deep happiness and peace isn't possible. But to the extent that we do experience ourselves as part of the forces of resolution in the world, sure, we'll still resonate with the suffering of the world. It'll still be an experience of pain. But perhaps some of the inner conflict and doubt will abate. We're not troubled by it in quite the same way. And the bodhisattva path is something beyond our own practice. I think it's one of the great paradoxes of the Buddha's path. We might set out on the spiritual path with high and precious goals of personal attainment, to experience dhyana, to become wiser, to become a wiser person, to gain insight, to gain enlightenment. And yet when they come, after all that effort, they are in a certain way incidental. the both crucial and yet incidental, to the great matter in hand, the great work in the scheme of the Bodhisattva. This suprapersonal, beautiful, unbounded love for all that lives. Our place in it is both crucial and yet at the same time not so much. And that's actually a great relief. It's not about us. And yet it is about us. So the Dharma that we need to embody and communicate in the 21st century is the opposite of what modern society might expect. It's not merely a path of personal attainment or mindfulness or calm or mere self-realization. We're not adding sort of exotic adornment to our lives, the exotic adornment of sort of spiritual qualities or escaping into esoteric mystic states. If that's what people want from us, we need to hold those ideas up to them like some precious ornament and smash them in front of their bewildered faces. The Dharma is about waking up to the nature of life. It's a profound turning about at the seat of consciousness, turning our lives, turning the world upside down. That's the Dharma revolution. That's the life of the 21st century Bodhisattva. The world needs the Dharma. It's what Sangharakshita set us up to do. So, to conclude with the paraphrasing Shantideva, may we be the doctor and nurse for all beings until the world is cured. May we be food for the hungry and wealth for the poor. May we be a protector for the unprotected, a guide for the lost, and a boat to the other shore. May we be a lamp for those who need light, and a bed for those who need rest. May we be a servant to all beings.